He fell back, but the radio officer, Lieutenant Commander L. Windsor, grabbed his hand just in time and pulled him through. As Isquith got to his feet, he slipped and bumped down the side of the ship into the water. Half dead with exhaustion, harassed by strafers, he was helped by his crew to Ford Island. Others never left the ship. Fireman John Vason in the dynamo room, who kept the power up to the end. Chief water tender Peter Tomick in the boiler room, who stayed behind to make sure his men got out. Lieutenant J.G. John Black, the assistant engineer, who jammed his foot in a cabin door. Mess attendant Smith, who was always so afraid of the water. Of the other ships on this side of Ford Island, the Tangier and Detroit were still untouched, but the Raleigh sagged heavily to port. Water swirled into number 1 and 2 fire rooms, flooded the forward engine room, contaminated the fuel oil, knocked out her power. In the struggle to keep her afloat, no one had even time to dress. As though they went around that way every day, Captain Simons sported his blue pajamas. Ensign John Beardall worked the port anti-aircraft guns in red pajamas. Others toiled in a weird assortment of skivvies, aloha shirts, and bathing trunks. Somehow, they didn't even seem odd. As signalman Jack Fopel watched Captain Simons in the admiral's wing on the bridge, he only marveled that any man could be so calm. Ford Island, where all these ships were moored, was itself in chaos. Japanese strafers were now working the place over, and most of the men were trying to make themselves as small as possible. Storekeeper Jack Rogowski crouched under a mess hall table nibbling raisins. The men in the air photo laboratory dived under the steel developing tables. Some of the flight crews plunged into an 8-foot ditch that was being dug for gas lines along the edge of the runway. This is where Ordnanceman Quisdorf's unit was hiding when he and another airman arrived in the squadron truck. But they didn't know that. They thought they'd been left behind in a general retreat. They decided their only hope was to find a pair of rifles, swim the North Channel, and hole up in the hills until liberation. Nor was there much room for optimism in the Navy Yard. On the ships at the finger piers, the stern gunners had a perfect shot at the torpedo planes gliding down Southeast Lock, but most of them had little to shoot with. The San Francisco was being overhauled. All her guns were in the shops. Most of her large ammunition was on shore. The repair ship Rigel was in the same fix. The St. Louis was on limited availability while radar was being installed. Her topside was littered with scaffolding and cable reels. 3 of her 4-5-inch anti-aircraft guns were dismantled. The little Sacramento had just come out of dry dock, and in line with dry dock regulations, most of her ammunition lockers had been emptied. The Swan plugged away with her 2 3-inch guns, but a new gun earmarked for her top deck was still missing. A pharmacist's mate stood on the empty emplacement, cursing helplessly. The other ships were having less trouble, although there was little power on the New Orleans, and to Seaman L.A. Morley on the Honolulu, just about everything seemed secured for the weekend. On all these ships, the men had more time for reflection than their mates along Battleship Row. On the New Orleans, the ship's gambler and big operator sat at his station reading the New Testament. Later he canceled his debts and loans, threw away his dice. A young engineer on the San Francisco, with nothing to do because her boilers were dismantled, appeared topside, wistfully told Ensign John E. Parrott, "Thought I'd come up and die with you." Machinist's mate Henry Johnson on the Rigel remarked that now he knew how a rabbit felt, and he'd never hunt one again. A few minutes later, he lay mortally wounded on the deck. Their very helplessness turned many of the men from fear to fury. Commander Duncan Curry, strictly an old Navy type, stood on the bridge of the Ramapo, firing a .45 pistol as the tears streamed down his face. On the New Orleans, a veteran master-at-arms fired away with another .45, daring them to come back and fight. A man stood near the sub-base, banging away with a double-barreled shotgun. A young Marine on 1010 dock used his rifle on the planes, while a Japanese-American boy about 7 years old lit a cigarette for him. The butt of his cigarette was burning his lips, but he never even noticed it. As he fired away, he remarked aloud, "If my mother could see me now." 1010 dock itself was a mess, littered with debris from the Helena and Oglala alongside. In the after-engine room of the torpedoed Helena, chief machinist's mate Paul Weisenberger fought to check the water that poured aft through the ship's drain system. The hit had also set off the ship's gas alarm. Its steady blast added to the uproar. Marine Second Lieutenant Bernard Kelly struggled to get ammunition to the guns. In keeping a steady supply flowing, it was a toss-up whether he had more trouble with the damage or with conscientious damage control men who kept shutting the doors. Topside was a shambles. The Helena's forecastle, which had been rigged for church, looked as if a cyclone had passed. The Oglala to starboard listed heavily. Her signal flags drooped over the Helena's bridge. Across the channel, Battleship Row was a mass of flames and smoke. Above the whole scene, a beautiful rainbow arched over Ford Island. Just below 1010 dock, the Pennsylvania and destroyers Casson and Downs sat ominously unmolested in dry dock number 1. Likewise, the destroyer Shaw in the floating dry dock, which was a few hundred yards to the west. Aboard the Pennsylvania, the men waited tensely. Lieutenant Commander James Craig, the ship's first lieutenant, checked here and there, making sure they would be ready when the blow came, or at least ready as a ship out of water could be. He told Bosun's mate Robert Jones and his damage control party to lie face down on the deck. He warned them that their work was cut out and to be prepared for the worst. On deck, the gunners were getting in a few licks in advance. For gunner's mate Alvin Girth, captain of one anti-aircraft gun crew, it was already hard, dangerous work. The electrical system had gone haywire, and he could fire by percussion only. On top of that, the ammunition was so old he had a lot of misfires. Normally, he could throw them over the side, but the ship was in dry dock, so that was out of the question. He piled them on deck behind the mount, gradually transferring the area into a little arsenal wide open to the sky. Not very safe to do, but he figured his time was up anyhow. It was much the same on the ships anchored in the harbor. Radioman Leonard Stagic sat by his set and the destroyer Montgomery writing prayers on a little pad. In the transmitter room of the aircraft tender Curtis, radioman James Raines sat with three other men listening to the steady booming outside. No orders, so they just waited. With the doors and portholes dogged down and the ventilators off, it grew hotter and hotter. They removed their shirts and took turns wearing the heavy headphones. Still no orders. They kept moving about the room, squatting in different places, always wondering what was going on outside. From time to time, the PA system squawked meaningless commands to others on the ship, which only made them wonder more. Still no orders. But the most exasperating thing to those at anchor was just sitting there. It took time to build up enough steam to move, an hour for a destroyer, 2 hours for a larger ship. Meanwhile, they could only fire their guns manually, dodge the strafers, and watch, to use their favorite phrase, all hell break loose. The destroyer Monaghan had a slight edge on the others. As the duty-ready destroyer, her fires were already lit, and then, of course, she'd been getting up steam since 7:50 to go out and contact the ward. Commander Bill Burford would be able to take her out in a few minutes now, but at a time like this, that seemed forever. At the moment, the destroyer Helm was still the only ship underway. 20 minutes had passed since Quartermaster Frank Handler genially waved at that aviator flying low up the channel. After the first explosion, Commander Carroll quickly sounded general quarters, swung her around from West Lock, caught Admiral Furlong's sortie signal, and was now ready to get up and go. Turning to Handler, he said, "Take her out. I'll direct the battery." Handler had never taken the ship out alone. The channel was tricky, speed limit 14 knots, and the job was always left to the most experienced hands. He took the wheel and rang the engine room to step her up to 400 RPM. The engine room queried the order, and he repeated it. The ship leaped forward and raced down the channel at 27 knots. To complicate matters, there wasn't a single compass on board. Everything had to be done by seaman eye. But Handler had one break in his favor. The torpedo net was still wide open. So the Helm rushed on, proudly guided by a novice without a compass, breaking every speed law in the book. By this time, Handler was game for anything, so he took it in his stride when at 8:17 he came face to face with a Japanese midget sub. He saw it as the Helm burst out of the harbor entrance, first the periscope, then the conning tower. It lay about 1,000 yards off the starboard bow, bouncing up and down on the coral near the buoys. The Helm's guns roared, but somehow they never could hit the sub. Finally, it slid off the coral and disappeared. The Helm flashed the news to headquarters. Small Jap sub trying to penetrate channel. Signal flags fluttered up all over Pearl Harbor, telling the ships of the fleet. From the bridge of the burning West Virginia, Ensign Delano read the warning and sighed to himself, "Oh my God, that too." As the Helm began patrolling off the harbor entrance, Quartermaster Handler noticed several big Army bombers circling Hickam Field, trying to land. Japanese planes nipped at them from all sides. Handler could see the bullets ripping off big chunks of metal, but the pilots went about their business as though it happened every day. The B-17s were coming in from the mainland, 12 planes in the 38th and 88th Reconnaissance Squadrons under Major Truman Landon. It was a long flight for those days, 14 hours flying time. To save gas, the planes were flying separately instead of in formation. They were also stripped down, no armor or ammunition, their guns in cosmoline.